thinking about medical care economics is something that is, I think, instructive for us, because we so often run into this idea among our peers and friends and acquaintances and families that medical care is somehow different. It's special. It's a right or something that other things may not be. And so we need to think carefully about what happens when government gets involved in medical care. And I've got about three different ways to show you some of the problems. One is drawn from Ludwig von Mises' book Bureaucracy, and also some from Hayek and his famous Use of Knowledge in Society paper. I wrote an article on this, applying Hayek's Use of Knowledge in Society to medical economic issues for a journal published by the American Association of Physicians and Surgeons, which is a great kind of free market-oriented alternative to the AMA, and they've been staunch supporters of market-based medicine for many, many years. In fact, I believe one of the primary sponsors of Mises University for several years is involved in the AAPS. And you can talk to me later about that if you like. My father, incidentally, was president-elect of that organization when he passed away several years ago. Let's talk a little bit about the FDA. I am not the expert here on the FDA. Bob Higgs has arrived, and so he does a lot more than I could ever think to do on the FDA, as well as a whole lot of other issues. But let's talk a little bit about the problems that the FDA presents to society. First of all, there's this long approval process. When the FDA started a little over 100 years ago, the idea was to prevent medications from containing substances that were harmful to health. And then in 1938, manufacturers were required to demonstrate the safety of these substances as well. In 1962, they had to not only prove that they weren't including harmful substances, they didn't only have to prove that they were producing something that was safe, they also had to show efficacy. Well, this is adding to the hurdle that innovators in the pharmaceutical industry have to overcome before they can market their product. So prior to 1962, the FDA was required to approve a new product within 180 days. Unless it were proven not to be safe. Of course, safety is not a binary variable. There's a spectrum of safety, and that's another matter. After 1962, the time constraint was removed. So now, drug approval processes are very long. We have by 1967, the time period had lengthened to 30 months. By the late 70s, it was 8 to 10 years. And the testing cost has risen to astronomical levels, $800 million maybe for each new drug added to the market. And during the delay, people are suffering from whatever the drug is designed to treat. So people are dying in some cases, or at least suffering from the absence of this product. One example of this is Septra, which was an antibiotic. There was a five-year delay in introducing this to the U.S. market. One estimate by Nobel laureate, not that that's necessarily anything much anymore, but George Hitchings said that this delay cost 80,000 lives in the United States. 80,000 lives because it was delayed for 5 years. People who they estimate would have been saved if that drug had been available. Beta blockers. The lag in the FDA approval process for beta blockers may have cost 250,000 lives just in the United States. Bob Higgs, I mentioned earlier, has written on this issue, and he's edited this book called Hazardous to Our Health, FDA Regulation of Healthcare Products. So you can take a look at that. Somebody was asking me earlier in the week, what can I read on the FDA? And I had drawn a blank. I knew that there had been some things that Higgs had written, and this, I think, was the one I was trying to come up with at that time. Advertising for an approved drug for newly discovered uses violates FDA rules. So if you've got an existing drug and you find, oh, well, it, It could also do something else that we didn't think of before. Well, you got to get a fresh FDA approval for that. And some companies are just not going to find it worthwhile to revisit that expensive, lengthy approval process. So people may not find out about this new use. You can't legally advertise for it. And that means that people are suffering and dying. Even though the drug is available, it's legal. It's just not legal to tell people what it can do. There was another example of this kind of thing caused, this kind of problem caused by the expense and the lag. There was an article I read from the Wall Street Journal several years ago telling about a doctor at Boston Children's Hospital who had found that a nutritional supplement available in Europe was able to prevent and in some cases apparently reverse liver problems in premature babies, which is a common problem for premature babies. They have immature livers. You can't feed them normally because their digestive tract is not apparently mature. And he said, well, this is helping children, but we can only use it on an experimental basis in the United States. The company that made this product was not even going to engage in the FDA approval process. And this is a U.S. market. It's a very lucrative market. It's lots of money to be made here, but not enough to overcome the FDA's approval barriers. And the company said, well, we're not going to start this approval process for this drug because we have another product that will replace it in a few years anyway. And if we have to spend the money and the time to get the approval process, we're going to spend that money on the new drug, not this other one. So again, the FDA is keeping a drug out of the U.S. market that could save children, and it was disallowed. Tom DiLorenzo says that new drugs do consumers no good if they do not know about them. Advertising restrictions imposed by the FDA prop up the profits of incumbent drug marketers at the expense of newcomers in the industry and of consumers. Aspirin's an example of this. In the late 80s, companies making aspirin were told you can't advertise aspirin's benefits in preventing heart attacks. And they were told by the FDA, if you do this, then we're going to bring legal action against you. So as a consequence, we have possibly tens of thousands of needless deaths every year because of this, or at least we did for a time. Eventually, that was allowed. If you take the FDA bureaucracy and you match it with the CDC bureaucracy, the Centers for Disease Control, then you get a whole nother monster. The rotavirus vaccine, for example, almost all children apparently contract rotavirus by age 5. It's very, very common. It tends not to be very serious, but if virtually all children get it, then even a small incidence of complications can result in a fairly large number of hospitalizations. So we had about 55,000 hospitalizations and about 20 to 40 deaths a year. In 1998, the FDA approved RotaShield, which was a rotavirus vaccine, and the CDC then promptly recommended that RotaShield be used for all infants within a year of that approval. Okay, so the FDA has lifted the regulatory barrier, but then you have the CDC stepping in saying, okay, now that it's approved, we're going to make you use it, in essence. So over 1 million children were immunized, and they found that they've got a system in place to report vaccine-related illnesses and complications. And they had 2 deaths, not a very high incidence, 99 cases of bowel obstruction. But the problem is the system doesn't count or catch all of the injuries. And so this may be only about a tenth of the deaths. So if you've got a disease that's causing maybe 20 to 40 deaths a year, and then you've got a vaccine that's causing around 20 deaths a year, it's looking like more of a wash than anything else. on top of the fact that you're not really permitting, when the government sort of mandates a vaccine for admission into school, and then they require the school, it's requiring people to give up their own authority over what kinds of substances to put into their bodies. The rotavirus vaccine had other problems in the process by which it was approved and then mandated. One member of the CDC committee who was active in getting this mandated had a patent on the vaccine, was paid by a large pharmaceutical company to develop the vaccine, and did not recuse himself from voting on issues surrounding the vaccine. Several members of the FDA and CDC committees owned stock in drug companies and stood to gain from the government's immunization requirements. So we've got a kind of military-industrial complex, except this is pharmaceutical industry equivalent. There was a study in Lancet, a British medical journal, revealing that problems with Vioxx had been delayed. One 20-year FDA employee said, "What I believe they were trying to prevent from reaching the public was our estimates of the number of people who suffered heart attacks or died because of Vioxx use. I believe there were multiple levels of FDA management who wanted to keep the information of the magnitude of harm caused by Vioxx from the public and wanted to damage my credibility as a scientist. I would assume the reason this happened is because the FDA sees its mission primarily as one of serving the pharmaceutical industry. With Vioxx, the FDA looked the other way and America paid a severe price for it." Now, I'm not suggesting that the FDA should have banned Vioxx, but when the American people begin to think, "Oh, well, it's FDA approved, that must mean it's safe," and then this process is corrupted in these ways because of the inherent nature of bureaucracies to attract corruption, we end up with a more severe problem than if people had relied on other sources of information for evaluating product safety. It turns out that 10 members of the FDA panel who voted for Vioxx and another drug called Bextra not only had ties to their makers, but their votes were crucial for securing the favorable votes on the panel for both drugs. All right. The FDA is a kind of a case study of putting experts in charge of deciding what you should and should not be allowed to use in a certain category of products. In relation to pharmaceuticals, you have the FDA looking at the chemical effects of a product and assuming for a moment that these people are really genuinely interested in the best possible outcomes for human beings. Assuming away that their own self-interest in approving or disapproving various drugs. That's a large assumption, so I'm not saying that this is a trivial matter, but assuming that away for the moment, they are not on the spot in the examining room with the doctor and the patient trying to decide they're not privy to the information that allows the physician and the patient to decide what should be done. They don't know the particulars of the side effects for a particular patient, the financial constraints for a particular patient, the drug interactions for a particular patient, and other matters that may affect whether or not the drug is appropriate for an individual. That knowledge is dispersed. And as Conco and Arnett have said, they may know a lot about the drugs they evaluate, they may know their average effects, but they don't know about the individualized physiology of each patient. Clinical physicians who are in the examining room and talking to the patient and know about the patient are the ones who are best able to make those kinds of determinations. So a drug that the FDA decides is too dangerous for the public may in fact be the best option for a particular patient. And we've seen just kind of a more controversial and public story surrounding marijuana legalization. And the federal government has this kind of idea that, well, marijuana is inappropriate in general, therefore no one should be allowed to use it. And we've seen a few states saying, now, wait a minute, this ought to be a matter for individuals and their doctors to decide, and therefore they're starting to, apparently there's some cracks showing in the ability of governments to ban substances for everyone. Can the quality of a doctor-patient encounter be judged by distant authority like the FDA? And we'll see that there are other authorities that try to intrude as well. But can that knowledge of the circumstances of time and place be transmitted to a bureaucrat in such a way that that bureaucrat can then make an intelligent decision about whether or not that drug is appropriate or whether or not a particular treatment is appropriate? I'm going to move quickly through this, but what we have had in the United States for decades now is a system that tries to force doctors into a kind of a checklist of procedures for patients. And the autonomy of the doctor to offer advice to a patient and the ability of the patient to accept or reject that counsel from the doctor is being gradually undermined. Doctors are basically being forced to decide, do I do what this patient in front of me really needs, or do I follow the law? Do I follow the regulations? So conscientious doctors are finding more and more often that they are put into this very difficult position of having to creatively bend or break the regulations in order to truly help a patient. And so the government, not wanting doctors to break the rules, but being unable to catch a large number of the violations of their rules, end up making the penalties absolutely draconian. We can't catch you most of the time, but boy, if we catch you, we are going to stick it to you. And they do. And there have been criminal cases filed against doctors for violating bureaucratic rules, even if the violation was unintentional. Mises said in his book, Bureaucracy, this, by the way, if you were at the, I was at a function a few days ago, and Judge Napolitano was very kind to give the Mises Institute a signed first edition of Bureaucracy. It was a wonderful gift to the Institute, and it's a short book, but it's a really wonderful book. And if you haven't had a chance to read it, I would recommend it. Mises says that government must be, by its nature, formalistic and rigid. The core problem is it has no measure of success or failure because it's removed the price system to at least some extent. It may buy and sell some raw materials in the market. Governments building roads might buy asphalt from a private company and enter into a transaction that has a price. But it is, to the extent the government exists at all, it is removing the ability of the price system to provide information. And so we end up with formalistic requirements that have come in between the patient and the doctor and good decisions for people with various illnesses. I mentioned the AAPS earlier, Organization of Free Market Oriented Doctors, and a survey done about 13 years ago by the AAPS found that the Medicare system's structure made it virtually unavoidable for doctors to commit these kinds of errors that lead to fraud charges. 82% of doctors in that survey reported increased fear of prosecution or investigation in the last few years, the past 3 years before the survey. 71% said they were making changes in their practice to avoid the threat of prosecution. They were restricting access to Medicare patients simply to protect themselves against a violation of the rules that could cost them their medical license or even wind them up in prison. 20% said, and this number has almost certainly risen since then, said they do not accept new Medicare patients because of hassles or threats from Medicare. Only it was a smaller fraction that said it's, well, Medicare doesn't reimburse enough. Almost a fourth do not accept new Medicare patients, and of those who do, 9% do so only under special circumstances. More than a third have difficulty finding physicians willing to accept referrals of their Medicare patients. More than a fourth said they restrict, well, I think I mentioned this, they restrict services to Medicare patients. Now, the government, what do they call this now? The Government Accountability Office or something like this? In 2002, they conducted a study that found that 85% of the time, Medicare customer service representatives gave the wrong answer to questions posed by physicians regarding the proper way to bill Medicare. So you're a conscientious physician, and you want to avoid losing your license, going to jail, and all that kind of stuff. So you call Medicare, and you say, I don't know how to bill you, and I don't want to commit fraud. Tell me how to do it, and 85% of the time, you're going to get a wrong answer. So the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services said, we'll do better. So in 2004, they have 2 years to get better. 96% of the time, they're giving the wrong answer. I guess you could just call them, and whatever they say, don't do it, because that's the wrong answer. Sort of like the IRS has done, where apparently if you call the IRS and say, I'm not sure I know how to pay my taxes properly, I want to follow the law, tell me what to do, and they don't guarantee a right answer. In fact, the Medicare policies and regulations were so confusing that the customer service representatives and the policy experts in this issue could not understand them. We get conflicting incentives depending on how the regulations are written. Hospitals, with regard to Medicare and Medicaid, have an incentive to cycle a lot of patients in and out of the hospital because they're paid for the diagnosis. Once they're paid for the diagnosis, it doesn't matter what happens after that. You might as well boot them out of the hospital because you're not going to get any more for that. Physicians have an incentive to keep the patient in the hospital for a longer period of time because they get paid more, reimbursed more by Medicare and Medicaid according to the tests they run, the therapy that they prescribe, and so forth. Now, you might think, well, this will cancel each other out and it'll be a wash and people will be in there for about the right amount of time. Well, no. Some people will be there too long. Some people will be there too short of a time period. So depending on which side of the bureaucratic requirements has prevalence for any particular patient, the length of stay is likely to be distorted. Let's talk about rising costs for a few minutes. This is something we're always confronted with in various journalists' treatment of American medical care. They look at American medical expenses and they say, well, we're spending a larger fraction of our GDP on medical care than most of the rest of the world. And look at our results. I mean, look at our infant mortality rates. Cuba's infant mortality rate is supposedly better than ours. I actually was confronted with that once or twice by a student in the last few months, and I thought, there's no way. Cuba? So I looked it up. Well, I mean, the reason that it looks different, and the statistics for Cuba look better, is because they're measuring infant mortality differently. In the United States, we have a much more expansive definition of who qualifies as an infant, and if that child dies, then we count that as an infant death, and in Cuba, apparently, that's measured very, very differently. So a lot of these supposed disadvantages of our system are statistical artifacts. They're not really related to anything real going on. Incidentally, I should add here, In nothing I say from now to the rest of through the end of the presentation, you should not take from it that I think that the United States medical system is some kind of free market alternative to the rest of the world. It's a matter of how socialist are we, how socialist is the rest of the world, but the United States medical system is predominantly socialist at this time, and I would say it probably has been since the 1960s at least. If you want to defend the United States medical care system compared to some other country, fine. Just don't make the mistake of thinking that you're comparing a free market system to a socialistic system, because you're not. All right, why are we seeing rising costs? Boyapati suggests we've got employer-provided health insurance. That's aggravated by the IRS rules that say, well, if employers provide medical care insurance, then it's tax deductible. I never saw a tax deduction I didn't like, so don't get me wrong. But that tends to magnify the impact of insurance. Licensure, the obesity epidemic, intellectual property, all of these are contributing factors. But let's look at one of these, which is that you're developing a system in which you've got a set of intermediaries between the patient and the doctor. The doctor wants to treat the patient. The patient wants to be treated by the doctor. And then you get this third party inserting itself between the two. Care providers then, doctors, nurses, osteopaths, whoever, end up working for the regulators or according to their rules and working for the third party payers who are writing the checks to them instead of working for the patient. So we get two problems. They're really related. There's a moral hazard problem, which is the risk that the insured person is going to engage in activities that the insurer thinks are improper because they magnify the size of the claims. For example, several years ago, I was having some back problems, so I went to a chiropractor, and the chiropractor said, well, go get an MRI. I said, okay, so I went to get an MRI. It was, I think, that within a couple of days or the next day or something when I got in to see to get the MRI, try that in Canada. But when I went in, I didn't pay any attention to the price. I knew I was insured. And when I finally got the bill and I saw how much of the bill had been paid by the insurance company, I was stunned. An incredibly expensive procedure. But did I care about the cost? Well, no, I had health insurance. So the third party is paying the bulk of the bill for insured patients and doesn't give the patient very much of an incentive to be careful about costs. The principal agent problem, well, you've got the patient who's the principal. The patient wants things done by the agent, who would be the doctor. And then you get a third tier, at least one tier, of insurance companies. Let's see, so now the insurance company is, well, I've got a diagram for you. I'll show you how this works, probably a little better. So we get competing standards here. There's the patient up there at the top. There's the care provider there at the bottom. Then you get the insurance company on the lower right and the employer on the upper right. The employer is supposed to be providing the insurance. In fact, now it's going to be a mandate, apparently. And then you got the government over there on the left and all of these relationships. The patient wants certain things done. The employers competing, or the insurance companies are competing with each other to get the contracts with the employers. The patients are voting for government agents who are then going to regulate the care providers, and the insurance companies are lobbying the government, and the government is regulating the insurance companies. The insurance companies have efficiency standards they impose on the care providers. And all of this ends up being a tangled mess. Now, who's paying? Governments pay about half in the United States at the moment. Although there's such a cozy relationship between insurance companies and governments now that it's kind of hard to say, but insurance companies are paying maybe another 40%. Patients themselves are paying maybe 10, maybe 15% on average. Now, of course, there are some who pay much more than that fraction of their medical bill. But who's the care provider going to listen to? You follow the money. You listen to whoever's paying you. That's, you know, if the government tells you you need to follow this regulation and we're writing your checks, then care providers are going to listen to that. Not so much to the patient who is paying a little copay or a deductible or something and is getting a little sliver of the doctor's time. All right. This is what Obamacare has done. If you thought that was complicated. So now, let's see. We're over. I have one more. So now we have the federal government mandating that the employers provide health insurance. And just a few days ago, apparently, the government's the administration said, the Obama administration said, oh, well, you don't actually have to do that until later, after the midterm elections. So very convenient. And then there's also the mandate for the individuals. That's not been postponed. And the government is regulating and setting eligibility requirements for the state exchanges. The states, about half, I think, of the states have said, we're not going to set up a state exchange. The government then, or federal government then, sets up a federal exchange, coordinating with the IRS in order to ensure that the person has eligibility. The patient is then supposed to go to the exchange if the employer does not provide the medical insurance. The patient is, of course, paying taxes and getting subsidies to buy this insurance through these exchanges. Okay, now that's a simplified diagram. This is from the Joint Economic Committee describing, this is from several years ago, describing the system. You can get a full-blown PDF of this if you do the search for this. Joint Economic Committee's got a website, and they've got this on there. That's what we're actually dealing with. It's something like 2,700 pages of regulation, and it's tremendously confusing. Nobody really knows what we're dealing with. All right. Nationalized health care. This is a basic supply and demand diagram. If you've taken economics, you've seen these before, probably seen a few of these this week. And there's a demand curve downward sloping and supply curve upward sloping. And what happens if the government says, well, the price is going to be zero? Well, at zero, the quantity demanded is over here. The marginal cost of that quantity demanded is going to be somewhere up here. So if the government says, well, we're going to pay for medical care, like Great Britain did right after World War II, we're going to pay for all your medical care, don't worry about it, it's not going to cost you anything. Well, instead of stopping with the quantity of medical care where it makes sense to stop, that is, where the marginal cost and the marginal benefit are about the same, now the consumer is saying, we want a whole lot of medical care because you're paying for it, or somebody else is paying for it. So, I mean, think about how you order differently in a restaurant when you know somebody else is paying the tab. If the cost, the marginal cost to you is zero, order the lobster. All right. Miller, Benjamin, and North wrote in their little policy book that's been around for a long time, they said, a single government agency in each country acts as a monopsony, single buyer, of healthcare services on behalf of everyone. Individuals are either prevented from buying health care on their own or limited by government rules as to what they may buy. Like other monopsonies, these national health insurance systems force down the prices of the goods they buy, such as drugs, medical devices, and physicians and nurses' services. Canadian drugs are famously cheap, so Americans sometimes will try to go to Canada and buy drugs and then use them here because the Canadian government pushes the price down. You push the price down, and this in turn reduces the quantities of goods and services that suppliers will provide, particularly in the long run. The bad news, at least is if you are a consumer of healthcare services, is that less healthcare is provided. Pharmaceutical companies think, well, if the government's going to bargain our price down, we're not going to be able to recoup this enormous upfront investment that we have to make in developing the formula for the new drug and the $800 million for FDA approval. We're not going to be able to recoup that by selling the drug at the price we want to charge. You're going to force us to pay to charge a lower price. So pharmaceutical companies have a reduced incentive to innovate because of this. And we can see this in countries that have a more socialistic system in medicine than we do in the United States. This is Yuri Maltsev, by the way. I'd given Pat some links to some articles on medical care, and Dr. Maltsev is one of those. He, as you may know, defected from the Soviet Union and is very familiar with the Soviet system and how it worked. And he was writing not only about the British system, but in his article he wrote about the Soviet system of medical care as well. According to Maltsev, the Brookings Institution found that every year 7,000 Britons in need of hip replacements, between 4,000 and 20,000 in need of coronary bypass surgery, and some 10 to 15,000 in need of cancer chemotherapy are denied medical attention in Britain. Age discrimination is particularly apparent. If the government's not going to provide the large quantity of medical care that corresponds to the very high quantity demanded, then the government, by necessity, is going to ration who's going to get what. And it's not necessarily going to be who is willing to pay the most or who needs it the most. It's going to be whatever is the relevant political variables that encourage, that get politicians reelected and get bureaucrats more job security, higher pay. In Russia, he says, patients over 60 are considered worthless parasites, and those over 70 are often denied even elementary forms of health care. In the UK, in cases of chronic kidney failure, those who are 55 years old are refused treatment at over a third of dialysis centers. 45% of 65-year-old patients are denied treatment, and 75-year-olds and up rarely receive medical attention. In Canada, the population is divided into three age groups, and we get a similar kind of tier of who gets medical care and who doesn't. The government itself has, and we saw this argument for government provision or expansion of authority in medicine that, well, private insurers are denying coverage and we don't need to see people denied coverage, and so the government should provide more care. Well, Medicare denies a higher percentage of its claims than any private insurer. If you look at the number of physicians, there are fewer of them in countries that are very similar to the United States, except for the medical care system, like Canada. Fewer physicians per 1,000 in Canada. Fewer nurses per 1,000 in Canada. Maybe some of you might have been at Mises University 2 years ago. We had Ronald Hamowy here, and he gave a talk on Canadian Medicare, showed how it has failed. And if you can find that talk on the Mises.org website and take a listen to that, it's really good. Medicaid's costs, like Medicare's, have risen faster than the costs of private health care. Even though Medicare is covering elderly people, and the costs for the young have risen faster. So if anything, you would expect that non-Medicare age patients would have seen faster increases in their medical care costs, but that's not been the case. This is from some years ago. It only goes up to 2008 here. But you can see the black line here is the combined annual per patient cost of Medicare and Medicaid from 1970. It's gone up a lot faster than the combined annual per patient cost of all other health care in the United States. So government is a cost containment system. That's not how it is. I mentioned MRIs earlier. The United States has more MRI machines compared to the UK and Canada, and again, I'm not suggesting that the United States is some sort of bastion of free market medical care. Certainly not. More CT scanners in the United States. The UK has higher rates of death from heart attack, stroke, and cancer than the United States. Canada has higher rates for heart attack and cancer. Now, You may hear some places, well, if the United States medical care system is so great, why is it that, why is it, you know, it's not that great, but if it's so much better than the UK or Canada, why is it that our life expectancy doesn't seem to reflect that? Why is it that Americans seem to have worse health? Well, you can't lay all health outcomes at the feet of the medical profession. Americans may have higher rates of death in car accidents than Europeans and Canadians. Americans may have higher rates of obesity. So why are we blaming hospitals and doctors when we've got a higher rate of these conditions that are putting people in the hospital in the first place? I mean, you can't blame the medical field for what happens on the highway. So we may have higher homicide rates than some other countries, and variety of reasons for that. But that's, you know, saying that the medical field here has been the victim of too much market intervention or too much market freedom compared to the intervention we see in Europe is to miss the reality. Cancer survival rates are better in the U.S. You know, that's where the medical profession actually has a little more influence compared to, say, accidental deaths. Among men, roughly 63% of those diagnosed with cancer survive for at least 5 years. For women, it's 66.3%. Most countries with a national health care system fare far worse. In Great Britain, it's only 44.8% of men and 52.7% of women who live for 5 years after their diagnosis. Here's wait times. This is commonly recognized that wait times to see a specialist are much shorter in the United States than they tend to be in countries that have nationalized healthcare systems. I mean, formally nationalized. 74% of patients wait less than 4 weeks in the U.S. Only 10% wait for 2 months or longer in the U.S. But if you're in Canada, 42% wait for more than 2 months. You're literally going to get medical care faster in Canada if you're a horse. And in Canada, only 40% get seen in less than 4 weeks. Germany is closer to the United States in the way they do their medical care system, and you'll notice that their percentages are closer to that of the U.S. 20% wait for two months or longer. They're on the low end here. Take a look at New Zealand, the U.K., Canada and Australia, all of these with nationalized healthcare systems, and people tend to wait a long time. And then you get this. This is older, but if you can't find medical care, it's no good, even if it's free. I mean, if it's free and I can't find it, what am I going to do? Well, apparently, if you're in Britain, you end up pulling out the pliers. And do I have any? Do I have any students here from Britain? No? So I can just lambast the Brits. And... Oh, I forgot. I'm being broadcast or something here. So I guess I should issue an apology, but I don't really want to. So, but apparently some English people have resorted to pulling out their own teeth. Now, British are not exactly known for their fine dental hair. If you ever watch the Austin Powers movies, you know this. 6%. Now, 6% may not sound like a lot, but how many people in your country? Most of you are Americans. How many of you know people who have pulled out their own teeth? 6% out of those questioned in a survey of 5,000. What's 6% of 5,000? Several hundred. Right? Admitted they had resorted to self-treatment using pliers and glue because they can't find or afford a dentist. More than three-quarters of those polled said they had been forced to pay for private treatment because they had been unable to find a National Health Services dentist. Almost a fifth said they had refused dental treatment because of the cost. One respondent claimed to have extracted 14 of his own teeth with a pair of pliers. I took most of my teeth out in the shed with pliers. I have one to go. Now, I don't know whether that means he's got one tooth left in his head or whether, what's the, 32 minus 14 and he's got one rotten one left to pull out. I don't know. But other people said they'd fixed broken crowns using glue to avoid costly dental work. And this is a, dental insurance is far less widespread in the United States than regular medical insurance. And so we're comparing, the difference there is even more stark between the U.S. and the U.K. Oh, here's one more, just in case you didn't get enough. Valerie Halsworth told British television's GMTV she had removed 7 of her own teeth using her husband's pliers when her toothache became unbearable and she was unable to find... If you ever watch that movie, what's the movie with Tom Hanks, who he's on a desert island, and Castaway, okay. And he goes through that whole process where he's by himself on this island, he's got to somehow figure out how to use an ice skate to knock one of his abscessed teeth out. We're descending to that level here, destroying the access to medical and dental services. All right, to sum up here, and then I'll give you a minute or so for questions. Pharmaceutical regulation kills people. We saw this with Septra and Vioxx and beta blockers and some other cases where delay killed people. Bureaucracy produces rule-based behavior instead of this more flexible, entrepreneur-directed, discretionary behavior resulting in more death and more suffering. Including pulling your own teeth out. Principal-agent problems emerge as third-party payers separate the patient from the doctor. This is being aggravated now by changes in the United States medical system. And then moral hazard problems that are created by these third-party payers, insurance companies, governments, and regulatory agencies. This increases medical costs, leading governments to ration care. Now, I did not go into some of the other things about how the Obamacare has threatened employers that some of them are starting to cut back on their workers so that they fall under this 50-employee threshold and turn workers from full-time to part-time to avoid this. And there's all kinds of other economic effects that we didn't get to today. I just don't have time. But I'll take some questions if you have them. I can get this to... There we go. That I mentioned my dad was a physician. That's him right there when he was doctoring. Okay. Yes, in the middle.
I have a question. My question is, if you go on Medicare, could being on Medicare restrict you from getting all the types of medicine on the market?
I was just talking to Don Prince a few days ago here this week, and he was explaining to me that, in fact, there are, let's see, I'm trying to remember exactly the details of the story, but apparently, yes. There are limits. Now, it's not so much that the government's going to say, well, the doctor's not allowed to do X or Y or Z, but by capping payments, they're imposing a price ceiling in principle and creating a shortage. So even if the technology is available and the drug is available and the physician in principle does not object to doing the service, by capping payments, and apparently Obamacare is likely to reduce that price ceiling further, that itself would tend to limit access and create shortages. This is stuff that's there are procedures that have been around for a long time. They're available, but people just aren't as willing to do them. And I'm deviating a little bit from the Medicare here, but we see an example of that with obstetricians leaving their specialty because their insurance premiums are so high. if you add to the cost of doing a particular aspect of medicine, there's going to be less of that medicine available, whether that cost is because of malpractice insurance premiums or because the government's just capping your reimbursement. Other question? Yes, back here on the... Now, I'm not familiar with that case. They listed their prices, and because they dared to advertise their prices, they were...
And they basically cut out insurance companies. They cut out third-party
direct. Oh, fee-for-service, returning to... And they were lower prices, I suppose. Okay. Yes, you're starting to see doctors that are doing that now. In fact, my family doctor does not hire people to in his office to file insurance. He says, you just pay me a fee. If you can succeed in extracting money from your insurance company, more power to you, but he's just not getting involved. And you see more doctors doing this, partly because of the overhead, so they don't have to hire the staff of people whose only job is to deal with Medicare, Medicaid, and insurance companies. And part of it is, if you're not dealing with those bureaucracies, you're not putting yourself in a position of committing fraud. So I expect to see more of that kind of thing in the future, and that would be wonderful. Yes, right here in the middle. Yeah, we've got a system, and have had in the United States, a system for a long time where the doctors, the major doctors' organization, accredits medical schools. You have to have graduated from an accredited school for the state to license you to practice medicine. So the medical profession itself has put itself in a position of being the gatekeeper to its own profession. What incentive would a medical, what would any profession have to bring more providers into, more suppliers into the market? I mean, there's an incentive for any supplier to restrict competition, and we've set up the medical profession to do exactly this. We say, now, if you want to practice medicine in the state of Alabama or someplace, you have to have graduated from this school or this school, which are accredited, or some other state school that we have a partnership with. And who limits the number of seats in that medical school? Not the school. They're told, essentially, if you want to be accredited, you have to follow these restrictions imposed by the medical profession. And this is driving some people to try to find alternatives, other forms of health care besides the traditional health care. And it's created a tremendous constriction on the supply of new doctors. It's doctors who are already practicing medicine may enjoy this because it means less competition for them, but it imposes huge costs on patients. I think I'm out of time, so I better stop. But thank you for your attention very much.